Welcome to the Back Ass Words podcast. We are the Back Ass Words boys. I'm Kyle. I use he, they pronouns. And joining me from our amazing, wonderful, crystal clear Colorado studio is Arden.
And I use... I used to clear my throat before the show, but now I do it during the show. And additionally, I also use he, him pronouns.
Tonight, guys, gals, and NB pals, I am going to be telling you about the Dietlov Pass incident. And this is going to be part one of probably just a two-part series here.
Mm-hmm.
Just doing a little dive in on the Dietlov Pass. I was sitting here yesterday in wonderful, sunny Utah.
Mm-hmm.
And despite it being well into April, it was snowing. And we had something else planned for this week, and I thought, you know what? I'm going to hang on to the cold, cold grasps of winter with a very cold story.
And can I just say that I am very, very, I don't think apprehensive is the right word, but I also don't feel like nervous is the right word. I am terrified to talk about this because I am afraid of what my brain is going to go through psychologically empathizing with these people, because that's all that I do during stories like this. And this is such a dire circumstance and I am so afraid to think about it, if I'm being honest with you.
Yeah. This is one of those stories that, much like JFK, for every theory that you accept as truth, there's two pieces of evidence that prove it wrong, you know?
Yeah.
And like Arden said, it's a very, very dire circumstance that this group found themselves in. And with that being said, guys, tonight's episode is going to get into some topics that might be sensitive for some of our listeners. Talking about the Dietlov Pass incident means talking about incredibly dire circumstances, and we are going to be going into some pretty explicit detail describing the deaths of this group. We care about our audience, and we want to make sure that you folks are safe as possible while listening, so if tonight's episode doesn't work for you, we'll see you in our next series.
And this is your reminder to always take care of yourselves when consuming media. If you don't know what you're getting into, you might not know how you feel coming out the end of an hour-long podcast, so take care of yourselves, and we'll see you in our next series. Like Kyle said, probably just going to be a little two-parter here, so we'll see you soon.
Yeah. And as always, guys, we are going to list our sources before we get into it this week. And of course, the first stop on the research train was our good friend, Wikipedia.
Because we stan Wikipedia on this motherfucking podcast, in case you forgot.
Go ahead and throw them a couple of bucks if they can. If you can, I'm sure they could use it. I used their pages on the Dietlov Pass incident and on hypothermia. My main resource for this week's episode, though, and next week's episode, was dietlovpass.com. They have done amazing research on this case.
Wow.
However, I did also use an article from abcnews.com titled "The Dietlov Pass Incident Sparked Terror and Conspiracy Theories, but Has the Mystery Finally Been Solved?" I also used an article from the New York Times titled "Researchers Find Another Clue in the Dietlov Pass Mystery." And we used another friend of the show, allthat'sinteresting.com, and their page on the Dietlov Pass incident.
Wow. This really is feeling like a classic episode here with all these classic sources that we've used over the past couple of years. It's awesome. And shout out to dietlovpass.com. I'll definitely have to check them out, Kyle, considering.
Yeah, you will. But guys, we are not scholars, and we are probably going to get some things wrong.
Absolutely. It sounds like that this case is saturated with conspiracy and a bunch of theories and a bunch of ideas of how this went down. So please, 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 I beg of you, spare us.
Please. And we are also not linguists. I'm not even going to say probably. We are definitely going to say some things wrong this week. There's a lot of Russian in this, and I'm so sorry. I'm going to butcher names, going to butcher locations. It's just going to happen. I apologize in advance.
And Kyle apologized to me in advance because I have some quotes where I will be mispronouncing some words for sure.
Yeah, I would love for us to be at the point that we can have someone come in and help us with pronunciations, but we're not there yet.
We're not there quite yet. Subscribe to the Patreon.
Yeah. Hey, subscribe to the Patreon. Hey, 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 guys.
Hey, hey, hey.
Subscribe to the Patreon. It's so much fun over there. Get into the Discord. Come chat with us. Get access to the bonus show, the Wednesday Phenomena.
Wednesday Phenomenon.
Wednesday Phenomena. It's so much fun. Please join us. Now, hold on to your asses, because things are about to get backwards.
I have a feeling that, am I wrong in assuming that this is a Professor Kyle episode? Because I feel like that's what I'm about to embark on.
It's, yeah.
Kind of?
It might be.
History Professor Kyle? Yeah.
Yeah, this is History Professor Kyle. This is not Alien Professor Kyle or Conspiracy Professor Kyle.
Oh.
They're both gonna come in and teach a little bit, but
Professor Kyle, allow me to dust off the chalkboard from the JFK series, all 12 of your chalkboards from the JFK series.
Is that 6 bullet casings? What? Ooh, get rid of those. Jeez.
Please, return this to the Department of Defense, Professor Kyle.
My theories.
Take us into it, Kyle. We're super ready.
No, you're not.
No, I guess not. Super ready. Yeah, I guess I was a bit presumptuous by saying we're super ready.
When search parties finally found the bodies of the 9 missing hikers, now known as the Dyatlov Group, in the Ural Mountains, the scene was so horrifying and so chock full of contradictions that it would inspire conspiracy theories for decades to come. Frozen corpses, mixed up clothes, strange injuries and missing body parts, curious levels of radiation. Each discovery was more perplexing than the last. Who or what killed 9 young and extremely experienced hikers on the slopes of Dead Mountain in western Siberia in 1959? For years, this tragedy has been analyzed and debated by scientists, amateur sleuths, podcasters, and real journalists. Whether it was murder, a Soviet military test, aliens, or even a Yeti, it seems no one can really agree on what happened on Dead Mountain.
Yo, what a premise. What an opening paragraph. What the hell?
We got to build to it, Arden.
Yeah, I guess so. That's what this episode is for, huh? Is building to it.
Oh, we're going to be doing a lot of building this episode.
Ooh.
In 1959, a group was formed for a skiing and mountaineering expedition across the northern Ural Mountains in Sverdlovsk Oblast in the Soviet Union. According to state prosecutor Ivdel Templov, documents that were found in the tent of the expedition suggest that the expedition was named for the 21st Congress of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union and was possibly dispatched by the local Komsomol organization, which was a political Leninist club in the area. Igor Dyatlov, a 23-year-old radio engineering student at the Ural Polytechnical Institute, was named as the leader. As the leader, Dyatlov assembled a group of 9 others for the trip, most of whom were fellow students and peers at the university. The initial group consisted of 8 men and 2 women, but one member turned back early due to health issues and never made it on the trip.
Okay.
On the trip proper.
Right.
Each member of the group was an experienced grade 2 hiker with ski tour experience and would be receiving grade 3 certification upon their return. At the time, grade 3 was the highest certification available in the Soviet Union and required candidates to traverse 300 kilometers in harsh conditions on a trip that totaled 900 kilometers and at least 16 days.
Wow. Okay. So these guys were essentially going on this trip to get certified as real deal hikers, and they were already real deal hikers at this point.
Yeah, this was equivalent to being like backcountry search and rescue certified, right? Like they already have a lot of experience. They know what they're doing, but this is just proving that, right?
Right.
And that is what this trip was for a lot of these people, was to get this certification.
Right.
The route was designed by Dyatlov's group to reach the far northern regions of the Sverdlovsk Oblast and the upper streams of the Lozva River. The route was approved by the Sverdlovsk City Route Commission, and they confirmed that the group of 10 people on January 8th of 1959. The goal of the expedition was to reach Otoren, a mountain that was 6.2 miles north of the site where the incident eventually occurred. This route, estimated as a Category 3, was undertaken in February, which was the most difficult possible time to traverse this route.
And they did that intentionally.
I mean, yeah, they were in a bit of a rush to do this trip. They were all very excited.
I see. Okay.
On the 23rd of January 1959, the Dyatlov group was issued their route book, which listed their course as following the number 5 trail. At that time, the City Committee on Physical Culture and Sport listed their approval for 10 people. The 10th person listed was Semyon Zolotaryov, who was previously certified to go with another expedition of similar difficulty. However, he dropped out before the expedition. The Dyatlov group left Sverdlovsk City on the same day that they received their route book. Again, they were all very excited to get going.
Mm-hmm.
The group arrived by train at Ivdel, a town at the center of the northern province of Sverdlovsk Oblast, in the early morning of January 25th, 1959. They then took a truck to Vizhai, a village that is the last inhabited settlement to the north in the area. While spending the night in Vizhai, the skiers purchased and ate loaves of bread to keep their energy level up for the following day's hike.
Smart.
On January 27th, they began their trek toward Gora or Torin. On January 28th, one member, Yuri Yudin, who had several health ailments, including rheumatism and a congenital heart defect, turned back due to knee and joint pain that made him unable to continue the hike. The remaining 9 hikers continued the trek.
So, things that I'm noticing that are really good here is that, like, they're obviously being very intentional about this trip, and they're not going alone. Like, none of them are by themselves at this point. And they're also, like, preparing in advance for, like, what they're about to do. And, I mean, this dude was even smart enough. Yuri was even smart enough to turn back and be like, I know I'm not going to be able to do this. I need to go. So, like, it shows, it demonstrates that they are experienced, again, you know, to just kind of drive that point home. Which I know that we already mentioned that, like, we're going to talk about a lot of deaths, but I feel like that contributes to the tragedy of this event. You know what I mean? To, like, really understand that these people are smart and experienced and have done this before.
Absolutely. Diaries and cameras found around their last campsite made it possible to track the group's route up to the day preceding the incident. On the 31st of January, the group arrived at the edge of a highland area and began to prepare for climbing. In a wooded valley, they cached some surplus food and equipment that would be used on the trip back. The next day, the hikers started to move through the pass. It seems they planned to get over the pass and make camp for the next night on the opposite side. But because of the worsening weather conditions, snowstorms, and decreasing visibility, they lost their direction and deviated west, towards the top of Kolat Saikal. When they realized their mistake, the group decided to set up camp there on the slope of the mountain rather than move 1.5 kilometers, or just short of a mile, downhill to a forested area that would have offered some shelter from the weather. As they pushed through the hostile climate towards the base of the mountain, they were hit with snowstorms that ripped through the narrow pass. The mountain they were stuck on is known as Kolat Saikal, meaning dead mountain, in the language of the indigenous Mansi people of the region. And it was called Dead Mountain, not because, like, bunches of people had died there. It was mostly called that because there was no, like, game or forgeable goods really there, right? There was nothing of value to those people there.
Right. Still a really ominous name for a mountain.
Oh, yeah. To avoid losing the altitude they had gained, or maybe simply because the team wanted to practice camping on a mountain slope before the ascent of Orton, Dyatlov called for their camp to be made there. It was on this solitary mountainside that all 9 hikers of the Dyatlov Pass incident would meet their demise. How are you feeling right now, Arden?
I mean, this kind of stuff is, like, really, really horrifying, and, like, not to get, like, too morbid before we get into the morbid stuff here, but it's just the thought of, like, being in that type of isolation, because, like, when we talk about isolation, we're usually talked about, like, being trapped like in a house or something, or like in a room, right? But this type of isolation is truly one of the more horrifying types of isolation to me, when you are isolated from any sort of, like, outside influence, and all that you have, it's like man versus man is one thing, but man versus nature is a whole other thing. And I think that's what really gets me about this. And I think about what these people have to go through leading up to their deaths, and just how insane and crazy and isolating is the only word I can really keep on thinking about, how isolating that must feel.
Yeah. I mean, they're already more than a day's trip back to any kind of civilization, let alone like a hospital,
right?
If someone needed it, you know, that's days travel.
And I'm sure that they were all trained in first aid and stuff like that, but that can only do you so much.
And they had, you know, they had a first aid kit, several first aid kits.
They were prepared
in their gear, but yeah, it's very harrowing. For sure.
I think that's also something that messes with me, kind of like what we've talked about on the show before, where, like, even the most incredibly prepared people can still be, we still have not conquered nature 100%, you know what I mean?
No.
We can't always fight against that.
Yeah, you can prepare as much as you want, but be it through severity or time, Mother Nature is going to win at some point, you know?
There's a threshold there, absolutely. Yeah.
Before leaving, Dyatlov had agreed that he would send a telegram to their sports club as soon as the group returned to Vizhai. It was expected that this would happen no later than the 12th of February. But Dyatlov had told Yuri Yudin before he departed from the group that he expected it to probably be a few days longer. When the 12th passed and no messages had been received, there was no immediate reaction, as delays of a few days were very common with such expeditions. However, by the 20th of February, the travelers' relatives demanded a rescue operation, and the head of the institute set the first rescue groups, consisting of volunteer students and teachers. Later, the army and police forces became involved, with planes and helicopters ordered to join the operation. When the search party set out in late February of 1959, they were still holding out hope that the hikers might be found alive. After all 9 members of the expedition, mostly young active students in their 20s, were highly skilled cross-country skiers. The search party climbed the slopes of Dead Mountain and realized that something had gone terribly wrong. They found a tent which appeared to have been slashed open from the inside and hastily abandoned. One of the rescuers, Mikhail Seravin, later recalled, quote,
The tent was half torn down and covered with snow. It was empty, and all the group's belongings and shoes had been left behind.
They then discovered 8 or 9 sets of footprints from the team, many of them clearly made by people wearing either nothing, socks, or at the most, a single shoe on their feet. These tracks led to the edge of a nearby wood, almost a mile away from the camp. Temperatures in the Siberian mountain range at that area and at that time of year would drop as low as negative 30 degrees Celsius in the winter, which for our Americans, let's do the conversion. It's about negative 25 degrees Fahrenheit.
Okay. That
and that type of cold, if you've never experienced that type of cold, it's like getting punched in the face mm-hmm. when you step out into that kind of cold. It is insane.
I am extremely, extremely disturbed by like the idea that the tent was slashed open from the inside. And then there's a bunch of people running out of the tent. I do not like that at all, Kyle. That is, no. I don't like it.
Jordan, let me show you how they found the tent.
Sorry, did you say show me?
Yeah.
You said you're going to show me how they found the tent?
Yep.
No? Kyle, please. Please spare me. So the tent is just like collapsed, or one of them is. There's like a bunch of snow on top of it. Then there's a second picture that Kyle sent me that I need to open.
So the second picture is they re-set up the tent.
Oh yeah, there are definitely some holes in that tent now. That do look like they were intentionally made. I guess I can't tell from my vantage point if they were slashed from the inside, but I wouldn't. I mean, very well could have been. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm trying to tread lightly with my language. I don't want to say anything too definitive, especially because I don't know a lot of the conspiracy around this right now.
Oh, we'll get there.
Oh, God.
With night falling and no sign of the hikers, the rescuers set up camp and passed around a flask of vodka that they had discovered in the abandoned tent. One of the rescuers proposed a toast to the health of the missing hikers. Mr. Charvadin later told the BBC, quote,
"We were about to drink it when one guy turned to me and said, 'Best not to drink to their health, but to their eternal peace.'" So at this point, they're accepting that these folks are dead. They're like, they're not. They're gone.
Yeah, Charvadin at least has accepted that. I mean, again, negative 25 degrees. You're not surviving very long.
Yeah.
Exposed like that.
Yeah, and it looks like they were exposed like that. Yeah, based off what they can see, that's what happened.
On February 27th, 1959, at 11 a.m., at a distance of 1.5 kilometers from the tent, two of the searchers found the first two bodies. The bodies were of Yuri Doroshenko and Yuri Krivonoshenko. The two searchers who found the tent were questioned during the investigation. Charvin said that by the time the investigation was conducted, he was in a hospital and therefore couldn't testify. Even more reason why there shouldn't have been a statement by Kopotelov. The statement in the criminal files is by a different searcher named Slobostov. And he said, quote,
"While looking carefully around the area, Mikhail Charvin noticed something dark close to a cedar tree. There was a flat area next to the cedar, and on this were the remains of a fire. About 2 or 3 meters from the fire, they found Yuri Doroshenko, frozen without his clothes and with his hand burned. And a little to the side,
they found Yuri Krivonoshenko in the same state. Under Doroshenko's body were 3 or 4 cedar branches of about the same thickness.
Can you picture that?
I'm sorry. Like, I really don't want to be disrespectful here, but that is such a weird and strange and unsettling circumstance to find a body in.
It is.
Naked, frozen, but with the hand burned. In the same state. So when they say that Krivonoshenko's body was in the same state, like, he also had a burned hand and was naked?
Was naked. Yeah, no burned hand.
Gotcha.
But he was naked. He did have some other small wounds that we are going to get to in a bit.
And then under Doroshenko's body were 3 or 4 cedar branches that were all the same thickness. I find that to be interesting, too. I wonder if he's, like,
It's getting him up off of the snow.
Right, exactly. Right.
That way he's not getting wet from snow melting.
That's kind of what I thought. So, again, like, demonstrating, their intelligence and their rationale in this scenario, which is interesting because they ran out of the tent naked, and yet at least Yuri Doroshenko is still demonstrating, like, some survival know-how, prowess, you could say.
Yeah, I mean, they even were smart enough to, you know, find the cedar tree that would create a little area underneath of some snow drift that they could hide in, you know.
Build a fire, which we know because Yuri's hand is burned, right?
And there were the remains of the fire under the tree. So.
Kyle.
Describing the condition of the bodies in the official record, Vasily Tempelov, the prosecutor in the criminal case, stated, quote,
Krivonoshenko's right leg has no footwear. On his left foot, there is a brown sock, torn. Another sock like this was discovered half burnt next to the fire. On the back of his hands, the skin is torn. Between the fingers, there is blood. The index finger is also torn. Skin to the left shin is torn and covered in blood. There are no more visible injuries on his body. Doroshenko has woolen socks on his feet, and over these socks are another lighter sock. His ear, lips, and nose are covered in blood, and on his left hand, the middle finger is bloody.
From Captain Chernyshev's official statement, quote,
It's possible to conclude that other people had since been by the fire. We found various garments next to it rather than on the bodies, but we didn't find any other bodies. The tree near the fire had been cut with knives, but we found no knives with the bodies.
One more quote, and then we can talk about him.
Okay.
Maslenikov stated that Doroshenko and Krivonoshenko, quote,
maybe, with the help of others, had made a pretty good fire with the branches of fir trees, but that fire had been alight for maybe an hour and a half. 8 centimeter branches of cedar had burned through.
And you know what's, like, the knives not being there is interesting to me, but one of the really interesting things to me about that is they said that they had made the fire with branches from a fir tree, right? But this was all happening under a cedar tree.
Right.
So they were bringing wood from a different tree to build the fire under this tree. It's just interesting to me. I don't know.
It is interesting. And I mean, first of all, my brain is absolutely melted right now. This is a really crazy circumstance. Another sock half burnt next to the fire, trying to like warm up his socks or something. And he like
maybe dry them out.
Yeah.
Next to this fire.
And also, like, I'm so disturbed by the state of the bodies. Like, Doroshenko's body, like, is like bloodied. Like, his face is all fucked up. His middle
and
finger is bloody.
And I believe it was, yeah, and Krivonoshenko, the way his hands were torn up, there was also, like, bark in them, like he had been trying to climb up a tree and had scraped up his hands, and that's how he had injured his hands, was trying to climb a tree somehow.
No. And then there was other people next to the fire. There were garments that did not belong to Yuri or Yuri next to that fire. I am assuming that other people are also trying to warm up, which means that it wasn't just the two of them. Those two just died there.
Correct.
Now the real question is, Kyle, was it members of their group or was it some sussy bakas?
Or was it nature?
Oh, nature, like, you know, like animals, like bringing the clothes close to the fire for some reason? Potentially.
Oh, no, I mean just that killed them.
Oh, well, yes.
Yeah.
I just mean, like, where did the other garments come from? What's in the fucking box, you know?
The search team sent another radio message in which they stated that the volume of work done here in making this number of cuts suggests that there were more people here than only these two. Not only that, but there were no knives under the tree.
Right. Especially because they're like hunting and gathering these fucking branches, you know what I mean? And the knives aren't there.
Exactly. Despite the remains of the fire, the two men had died of hypothermia. Curiously, the branches of a nearby tree were broken 5 meters up the trunk. Had they climbed it to get the lay of the land or to escape something? They both appeared to have scrapes and burns on their hands. On February 27th, between the cedar and the tent, the searchers found Igor Dyatlov, about 300 meters from the cedar, and Zenaida Kolmogorova, 630 meters from the cedar. And 6 days later, on March 5th, Rostim Slobodin, who was found 480 meters from the cedar. These three seemed to have died in poses, suggesting that they were attempting to return to the tent. A medical examination found no injuries which may have led to their deaths, and it was concluded that they had died of hypothermia. Slobodin had a small crack in his skull, but it was not thought to be a fatal wound. A legal inquest started immediately after finding the first 5 bodies. The search for the remaining 4 hikers took more than 2 months.
Jesus Christ.
And since we're going to be talking about it quite a bit more this episode and next episode, let's take just a minute here to talk about hypothermia. Hypothermia is medically defined as any body temperature below 35 degrees Celsius or 95 degrees Fahrenheit. And this method is divided into degrees of severity based on your core body temperature.
Mm-hmm.
Starting with mild hypothermia, whose symptoms may be vague with physiological responses to preserve heat, such as shivering, increasing blood pressure, an increased heart rate, an increased breathing rate, and a contraction of blood vessels. As hypothermia progresses into moderate symptoms, the symptoms include mental status changes such as amnesia, confusion, slurred speech, decreased reflexes, and loss of fine motor skills. And as the temperature decreases into severe hypothermia, further physiological symptoms falter, and heart rate, respiratory rate, and blood pressure all decrease. And this results in an expected heart rate in the 30s at a temperature of 28 degrees Celsius or 82 degrees Fahrenheit. There is often cold, inflamed skin, hallucinations, lack of reflexes, fixed dilated pupils, low blood pressure, pulmonary edemas, and shivering is often absent once you get to the high levels of hypothermia. Pulse and respiration rates decrease significantly, but fast heart rates can also occur.
Fucking horrible too. Like, it just sounds terrible.
And one of the most maybe misunderstood and commonly quoted symptoms of hypothermia is something called paradoxical undressing. It's something that you hear a lot brought up, especially with this case. 20 to 50% of all hypothermia deaths are associated with paradoxical undressing. This typically occurs during moderate and severe hypothermia as the person becomes disoriented, confused, and combative. They may begin discarding their clothing, which in turn increases the rate of heat loss. One explanation for the effect is a cold-induced malfunction of the hypothalamus, the part of the brain that regulates body temperature. Another explanation is that the muscles contracting peripheral blood vessels become exhausted, known as a loss of a vasomotor tone, and relax, leading to a sudden surge of blood to the extremities, causing the person to feel overheated, even though they actually are not.
Right. I was going to say that I feel like that's kind of the key component there, is that you feel like you're getting hot when you're actually not. Your body is just surviving.
Yeah.
Or attempting to.
Another apparent self-protection behavior, commonly known as terminal burrowing or hide and die syndrome, occurs in the final stages of hypothermia.
Eesh.
Those affected will enter small enclosed spaces, such as underneath beds or behind wardrobes or underneath trees. It is often commonly associated with paradoxical undressing. Researchers in Germany claim that this is obviously an autonomous process of the brainstem, which is triggered in the final state of hypothermia and produces a primitive, burrowing-like behavior of protection, as seen in hibernating animals. This happens mostly in cases where the temperature drops slowly. However, this does not explain why Doroshenko was brown purple in complexion, or why he had gray foam coming from his right cheek and a gray liquid coming out of his mouth.
What?
Experts say that this, combined with the chest injuries he sustained, could have come from common torture tactics of Stalin's secret police. Furthermore, this does not explain why the hands of the two hikers under the cedar were scraped away and the branches above them were torn down, as if the two men had tried desperately to seek shelter from something or someone in the tree. Meanwhile, Slobodin had head injuries consistent with someone falling and hitting their head over and over and over again. And Klomogovra had a baton-shaped bruise on her ribs. These two hikers, as well as the others found by this point, were also generally underdressed and wearing some of each other's clothing, only supporting the idea that they had fled suddenly and without adequate preparation into the freezing night, despite being experienced hikers. It was not until the other four bodies were found 2 full months later that what, Arden, all of the questions were answered wrong. The mystery deepened even further. I know I threw a lot at you there. How are you feeling, Arden?
You know, something that I hadn't really considered, because I was kind of following along with the hypothermia stuff. I was like, oh yeah, this is definitely like, I can see how they would act this way with like very severe hypothermia. But now that you put it that way, it is kind of like, I hate to say it this way, but it's like, I kind of think about like, what motivation would someone have to act this way?
Mm-hmm.
And I think about like, you know, like horror movies, like, because I've watched some like, you know, nature escape from other people, right, horror movies where like someone's like fucking tracking you and following you through the woods. And like, that would definitely, you would definitely run away if someone was fucking trying to get you, and you wouldn't necessarily be thinking straight and just trying to get yourself as far away from the person chasing you as possible. That mm-hmm. is something that I could see being a potential here now that yeah. you are mentioning it. That's to kind quote, of where I'm at.
Yeah, to quote that video I sent you, The Fear of the Cold, one thing he said that was really interesting is, speaking of motivation, what is going to motivate you to leave that tent, your only little yeah. safety bubble, into the cold that you know will kill you?
Yes, which again,
you are going to die if you leave that tent. So what does it take to motivate you to come to run out of that tent in the state they were in?
Absolutely. And again, like, it's such an interesting and ominous detail that it appears that the tent was cut from the inside. That is a very interesting detail right there. Mm-hmm. That's something that I can't rationalize quite yet, other than escaping something. And if you're cutting the inside of the tent, I imagine that whatever you're escaping is inside the tent with you.
The tent being cut open is one of the biggest grains of sand in the gears of this story. For sure.
God.
But those injuries that they found on those other two hikers are really interesting too. The skull fracture, consistent mm-hmm. with being, with your head being banged into the rocks repeatedly.
Right.
And then a baton-shaped bruise, which, I mean, in theory could potentially come from, like, a tree branch or something, right?
Right, right.
Let's not get too carried away with the conspiracy here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But
still interesting. Just, a, the remain- just something to note, you know what I yeah. mean? Just something to notice.
Absolutely. The remaining four hikers were discovered buried under the snow in a ravine 75 meters deeper into the woods than the cedar, known as the Dietlov Pass Den, and their bodies told even more gruesome stories than the other members of the group.
What?
Nikolai Thibault Brignol, age 23, suffered significant skull damage in the moments before his death. Reportedly, they looked like they came from repeated hits to the skull, while Ludmila Dublina, age 20, and Semyon Zolotarov, age 38, had major chest fractures that could only be caused by immense force comparable to that of a car crash. In the most gruesome part of the Dietlov Pass incident, Dubinina was missing her tongue, eyes, part of her lips, and a good chunk of facial tissue, and a fragment of her skull bone. They also found the body of Alexander Kolitayev, age 24, in the same location, but without the same kind of severe wounds.
What the fuck? And this was how long after they died, allegedly? 2 months?
Very good to bring up. 2 months, which I think explains the most gruesome part. Dubinina missing her tongue, eyes, and part of her lips. I think you can explain that as animals, right? I think that's a pretty yeah. safe bet.
Mm-hmm. But this is also Dead Mountain.
Yes, and Dubinina and Zolotarov also had major chest fractures caused by immense force. This second group of bodies suggested that the hikers had died at distinctly different times because they appeared to have been making use of the clothes of the people that died before them, lending criticism to the paradoxical undressing theory.
Right, because then they're not undressing themselves because of hypothermia. It's the survivors who are undressing their friends exactly. to survive.
And they also have the solidness of mind to be taking the clothes from their friends who have passed away and layering them on top, right?
Oh, God.
Dubinina's foot was wrapped in a piece of Krivonoshenko's wool pants, and Zolotaryov was found in Dupanina's faux fur coat and hat, suggesting that he had taken them from her after she had died, just as she had taken clothes from Kvronoshenko earlier. Perhaps the most mysterious of all was that the clothes of both Kolotayev and Dupanina showed evidence of being radioactive.
Get the fuck out of here, man. What the fuck? What are you talking about? What is that? What do you mean? Radioactive. Their
clothes were radioactive. They triggered Geiger counters.
And like above average readings of radiation too?
Significantly. There was initial speculation that the indigenous Mansi people, who were reindeer herders local to the area, had attacked and murdered the group for encroaching upon their lands. Several Mansi people were interrogated, but the investigation indicated that the nature of the deaths did not support this hypothesis. Only the hiker's footprints were visible, and they showed no sign of a hand-to-hand struggle.
Mm-hmm.
On top of that, the Mansi were known as an overall incredibly peaceful group of people.
Right.
At the time, the official conclusion was that the group members had died because of a compelling natural force.
Mm.
That was the official record. A compelling natural force.
I guess that makes sense.
The inquest officially ceased in May of 1959 as a result of the absence of a guilty party. The files were sent to a secret archive.
Interesting move.
Interesting move. In 1997, it was revealed that the negatives from Krishanovenko's camera were kept in the private archive of one of the investigators, Lev Nikitek Ivanov. The film material was donated by Ivanov's daughter to the Dyatlov Foundation. The diaries of the hiking party fell into Russia's public domain in 2009.
What?
The inquiry in spring of 1959 left many questions unresolved. Why did the skiers flee the tent to certain death in the wind and snow? What caused the blunt force trauma? Why did the analysis find elevated levels of radioactivity on only two of the victims' clothing? These questions were all beyond the purview of the official investigators who, while baffled, concluded that there had been no foul play and that the students were killed by an elemental force that the tourists were not able to overcome. A local journalist was barred from filing a report on the incident, and for decades, the only publication related to the mystery was a novel written by one of the searchers, although it did have a slightly happier ending. After hurricane force winds blow one girl down the slope and trap the others who rush to help her, the group leader attempts to return to the tent and dies, but the rest find shelter in a trapper's hut. But then came the breakup of the Soviet Union, future podcast episode. Which had much more significant fallout, but one of the other factors that did happen was that the curtain of silence was lifted over this traumatic pass. And well, not completely lifted. We still don't know what happens, you know. Right, but right, right. We learned a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
An unsolved mystery such as the Dyatlov Pass incident would no doubt rile up truthers in the United States, but the Russian obsession with the incident is above and beyond American internet forum debates on Area 51 and the Chupacabra.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas United States conspiracy theories often develop on the fringes of public life, a line that has admittedly been blurred since the Donald Trump era, conspiracy mongering is mainstream in Russia, a country in which 57% of the population believes the Apollo moon landings were a hoax.
Well, yeah, but I mean, of course they're going to fucking think of that, I mean, about that one. Yeah.
But if the Dyatlov Pass incident has shown anything, it's that closure will be elusive.
Mm.
Even a definitive judgment is unlikely to quell any speculation. In Russia, conspiracy theories are an essential part of daily life. Natalia Barasengova, who has been publishing articles on the case for the newspaper Komsomolskaya Pravda since 2012, told The Atlantic, quote,
"It's our Soviet mystery that we want to solve. Every person who starts researching it thinks he's the one who can solve it. But the deeper he goes, the more the swamp sucks him in.
Been there.
Yeah, me too.
And while this belief in secret plots typically begins at the grassroots level in the United States, in Russia, it has more often come from the top down. In the late 1800s, the Tsarist state began encouraging conspiracy theories targeting Jews and Catholics as a way to rally Russians against the West. The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, a fake document, it's fake. Holy shit, it's fake. It's terrible, and it's fake. It is often cited as evidence of Jewish plans for global domination by Adolf Hitler, was actually first published in Russia in 1903 at the height of the pogroms.
Wow.
And on this ripe ground fell the seed of the Dyatlov Pass mystery. In January of 1990, the former Communist Party head of a town near the Dyatlov Pass wrote a response to a newspaper article about a supposed UFO sighting in the area. In it, he described what happened to the skiers, claiming that holes in their tent were made by falling debris from a rocket test. The paper later published a story in which Lev Ivanov, the leader of the investigator of the 1959 Dyatlov inquiry, was quoted as saying that the students were killed by what, Arden? A UFO!
A UFO!
The article has also repeated rumors that the group could have been killed by the indigenous people or radiation from a nearby undisclosed weapons test.
Mm.
In fact, the balls of fire referred to in this UFO story had been seen weeks after the students' deaths and were attributable to documented missile tests. A few months later, Ivanov wrote in his own article in a different newspaper blaming the students' injuries on a heat ray or a strong energy that is completely unknown to us. With UFOs, secret documents, and hints of a government cover-up, Khrushchev was informed about the event from the very beginning. Ivanov wrote, "The articles were a conspiracy theory starter kit. An ever-growing web of theories has since emerged, claiming that poisoned alcohol, the descendants of ancient Aryan aliens, or a variety of fantastical weapons like a vacuum bomb were responsible. The fact that the deputy engineer of the Chernobyl nuclear power plant had the exact same surname as Igor Dyatlov raised some suspicions of connection to that disaster as well. Oh. Several theories even hold that the Dyatlov group included a KGB or CIA agent." As you can tell, this story really is about as ripe with conspiracy as JFK. And I really want to dive into this. We aren't going to be giving you 10 parts, but we will be giving you 2.
Hey.
So this is where we will pick up next week with part 2 of Dyatlov Pass theory.
Kyle, my good friend, my tinfoil hat wearing professor. Can I just say really quick, excellent work on this outline. And then can I say really quick, what the actual fuck, dude? What the hell? Okay. So first of all, of course the Nazis fucking pop their heads in here. I'm so surprised that I did not bring that up sooner. I'm having a hard time with this one. I'm not going to lie. And I know that we are going to save our back assward stance for the next episode, but I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around this circumstance, Professor. I don't know what's going on.
That's fair. There's a lot more to cover here. We've still got a little bit more before we get into it fully next week. But this story is absolutely nuts. again, every time you turn a new leaf, it turns over four more that you weren't planning on turning over, you know?
And here's the thing, like, other than the tent being cut from the inside out, I think another, like, really big, like, question that I can't answer, or one aspect of this case that is very harrowing, is the radiation. I don't understand yes. what that means.
Nope.
Or how that would come. And I feel like that's the only way that aliens plays into it, but mm-hmm. why would aliens just fuck with those two? That doesn't sound very consistent with other alien stories that we've heard.
Not
and
really.
Even like the debris dropping from the sky, like we kind of talked about it during the 1947 flying disc craze with the
Red yeah, and the Island most hoaxy account. One that we talked but about.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say, is like, that's the only other time that we've really talked about it on the show, and it was fake as fuck.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if that would have caused the hole in the tent. I think it's way more likely that someone or something cut that tent from either the outside or the inside. I can't say
for agreed. Sure.
Oh, it's spooky, dude. I don't like it. And Kyle did give me some homework. I do have to watch Fear of Cold before we record the next episode next week. And so
yes.
I feel like I'm going to learn a lot more about cryophobia before we get back next week, which I think will make the circumstance even worse, if I'm being honest with you. I think it'll make my mental state even worse. I'll say that.
That's why I told you to watch it, mostly.
Hey, there we go. Thanks. I really appreciate that. Thank you. Just like watching a documentary on the school book depository will just absolutely fundamentally change the way you look at your life.
Well, thank you so much for listening to the podcast, everybody.
Thank you so very much. I know that we just went through a really brutal, like, true crime series, and now we're hitting you with some survival horror, but it really does mean a lot that you folks are here if you've made it this far. Thank you so much. It means a lot.
Yeah, and we wanted to get some really heavy stuff out of our system before we cover something a little bit more, I mean, it's still heavy, but it's a little bit more, I want to give a little clue here, let's see, it's a little bit more rootin' tootin' than what we normally cover on the show
for this
summer, and I'm very excited for it.
I think that that's a fair way to describe it, so, But yeah, we are getting some heavy shit out of the way, but then we'll be coming back with some more fun stuff. At least I think it's a little bit more rootin' and tootin', like you said.
You can subscribe and review if you're enjoying the show, and if you think someone else will enjoy the show, please share it with them.
Because word of mouth is the best way to spread that the Backasswards podcast is now finally covering the most common fear, which is fear of the cold, cryophobia. And you know.
You know
that cryophobia is the most common fear, and that the Backasswards podcast is your favorite podcast.
You can listen to our previous episodes for more. I would recommend our little two-part series on Ed and Lorraine Warren.
Yo, if you want to learn more about like how weird they were, and part two in particular demonstrates how big of pieces of shit they are. It was really fun. It was kind of like our prelude to our October in 2023, which was a great month, by the way.
Oh, so much fun.
Highly recommend those episodes. You're going to learn a lot, I promise.
Yeah. You can follow me and Arden on Twitter. I am at BackassWordKyle. Arden is at Arden_Smith. And you can follow the podcast on all of your favorite social medias. On Twitter, at BackassWordsPod. Instagram, Backasswords Pod, TikTok, Backass Pod, and on Facebook, search the Backasswords Podcast. You can also find us over on Patreon if you want to support us financially, which would be absolutely insane and amazing of you. $1 a month gets you a shout out on the main show and access to our Discord, where we have so much fun. But if you want to really dedicate to the cause, really help us keep the lights on here, you can throw us $5 a month to join our Manchurian Candidate tier and get access to the other things, and also access to our weekly bonus show, The Wednesday Phenomenon.
It's so much fun, folks. You should really join us over there.
Tons of fun. We have a huge back catalog already. We got 20 episodes, over more than 20 episodes by the time this comes out. Yeah. And so, yeah, it's so much fun. Please help us out. We would appreciate it. I'm Kyle.
I'm Arden.
And we will see you next week, unless you go on a hike and get irradiated as fuck, dude. Like, what? Oh,
like, what? It doesn't make any sense.
Oh.
And when you're out on your hiking trip getting radiated, just remember to take out your Geiger counter so that you can determine how much radiation is coming into you so that you can stay safe.
And when you're on your hike getting irradiated, make sure that only two of you get irradiated so that you can stay weird and make me not sleep at night.
Oh my God, Jesus, the danger Christ. Is so real, my friends. Please stay safe out there. Please plan accordingly for your trips. Don't go by yourselves. Don't go... Honestly, like, getting level 3, is it worth it? I don't know. I don't know, man.
In February?
No.
Yeah, why couldn't they have waited like a month, you know?
No. That just... We'll see you next week. Stay safe out there.
Alrighty. You ready?
Yes! God on high, hear my prayer in my need.
That's huge ass, man.
You have always been there.
Welcome to the Backass Words podcast. We are the Backass Words boys. My name is Kyle, and joining us from our beautiful Colorado studio is Hugh Jackman.
He's afraid. Let him rest. That's how he sounds.